Good morning all, and welcome to the Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. Our next call will be on July 2nd, so please mark your calendars. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls usually work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means you've logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the attendees today, we asked for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. So what I've done is compiled a list, and when we get done through that list of pre-submitted questions, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line for any additional questions. So you have a couple options there. You can either enter in the questions box what your question is, or you can just say that you want to come on live, and I'll bring you on to the on live, and you can ask the question directly to us. Okay, now that we got that out of the way, joining us on the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes and bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Good morning. Be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. On the first Tuesday of each month, this practitioner's call is offered. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the third Tuesday of each month, we broadcast our featured webinar, Learn Audits, Offers, Installment Agreements, Appeals, and much more. If you forget what happens when, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And remember, we are here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. And another reminder, the VIP members get priority during these calls. So the first round of questions that we're going through here are coming directly from members. Now that we got all that housekeeping out of the way, let's go ahead and jump right into the calls. First member here is Fred. And Norman, Fred is asking, I want to appeal an IRS audit, but I've missed the 30 days to respond. What options do I have at this point? I was ill and forgot to respond. Will the IRS accept that as a reasonable explanation and allow me to request a hearing?
So there's really two parts to the audit and to appealing the audit results. So if you're referring to the 30-day letter, that's the letter that the auditor or revenue agent sends the taxpayer that says, here's a copy of my proposed report. If you have anything new to add or dispute it within 30 days, let me know and we can work together on it, or you can contact my manager. When that 30 days passes, then the audit report becomes final and the audit report is transmitted to the taxpayer along with a letter called a notice of deficiency. And that notice of deficiency is sometimes called the 60-day letter, because the notice of deficiency allows the taxpayer 60 days to file a petition with the U.S. Tax Court disputing the audit. Now, if the taxpayer misses that 60 days, then the tax court no longer has jurisdiction over the matter. And at that point, the taxpayer would have to file an OIC doubt as to liability. and that would be okay. So if you're talking about the 30-day letter, then if you've missed that 30 days, then all that means is that the notice of deficiency will be issued. And I believe I misspoke. It's 90 days, not 60, that the notice of deficiency gives the taxpayer to file a petition in tax court. So if the 30 days has passed and you haven't received the notice of deficiency yet, then wait for the notice of deficiency and file a petition in tax court. If the time is expired to file a petition in tax court, then your only option is to submit an offer in compromise, notice of liability, and explain why the audit is incorrect. And again, you should have new information, documents that weren't produced at the audit, or something new, not just arguing the same old stuff again.
All right, Fred, hopefully that gives you a little bit of guidance. Just be patient and you'll get that next notice coming here soon. Next question here from a member is Anne. Anne is asking, I've heard that it is best not to represent your client in an IRS audit if you were the tax return preparer for the year under audit. This is to avoid the audit expanding into your work papers and possible preparer penalties. Do you agree? And if so, what do you recommend?
Well, I think that, first of all, the tax preparer is usually the best person to represent the taxpayer in an audit because they prepared the return and they know the background. And so if the tax preparer is confident on their preparation of the return, then I think that it would almost be an obligation to stand behind the return and represent the taxpayer at an audit. I mean, if there's considerations, then I would wonder what those are and why the tax preparer isn't more confident in the work that they've done. As to expanding into work papers, there is no privilege communication between a tax preparer and a taxpayer, but I don't usually see that coming up. And I guess an attorney could represent the taxpayer in the audit like I do, but and have attorney-client privilege. But again, I'm not sure why that would be an issue where most audits is a Schedule C situation where they're, the issues are the expenses and proving the expenses or whether or if there's income that's unreported. So I would think that the tax preparer should represent the taxpayer normally in an audit unless there's some issues that either the tax preparer underreported income or overreported expenses. I wouldn't see that would be a problem.
All right, moving on to Jessica. Jessica, also a member, is asking, I have heard conflicting answers to this question. Can you please clarify if taxes can be discharged if the client did not file their own returns and the IRS filed an SFR?
Okay, so an IRS SFR stands for substitute for return. And what that means is when the taxpayer didn't file a return, the IRS prepared a return on behalf of the taxpayer using standard deductions and 1099s or W-2s from wage and income transcript. It's like an audit, and they determine tax liability. Now, usually the tax liability of an SFR is higher than if the taxpayer prepared their own return because the taxpayer, for instance, might use itemized deductions or other means to reduce the amount of tax liability. If a taxpayer files a bankruptcy and there's an SFR, if the SFR is the only return that is showing for the taxpayer for that particular year, then in no jurisdiction in the country that I know of would that tax be dischargeable, because everywhere it would be considered that the taxpayer didn't file a return. If the IRS files a return on your behalf, that's not the same thing as a taxpayer filing a return. Now, where the issue becomes a little bit trickier is after the SFR, if the taxpayer says, well, I don't owe this much because I itemize, and they file a return with itemized deductions, and it lowers the tax liability, and then the taxpayer files a bankruptcy. The issue is, well, if they filed the return and they filed the return more than 2 years prior to the bankruptcy and more than 3 years prior to the due date, the due date's 3 years prior to the date of the bankruptcy, is it then dischargeable? And that's where you come into a conflict in different jurisdictions. In some circuits, even if the taxpayer files a return after an SFR, it's still considered an SFR, and the taxpayer's return is ignored and it's non-dischargeable. In other circuits, for instance, the Ninth Circuit, where California is, there's a test called the Beer test, and it has to do with certain questions that's asked, like the taxpayer's good faith in filing the return after the SFR, and the reason why the taxpayer didn't file a return timely. And so it's potentially dischargeable if they can pass what's called the Beer test. So it really depends where the taxpayer lives and where the taxpayer files the bankruptcy. And sometimes it could be dischargeable and sometimes not. So it's not a black or white answer. But the moral of the story is you should really avoid having the IRS filing SFRs, and taxpayers should file returns, if not timely, at least prior to the IRS filing a return for them.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Next question here is from Melvin. Melvin's also a member. He's asking, I've submitted an OIC last month and waiting for the IRS to confirm receipt acceptance. How long would this take, and will it toll the statute while being reviewed?
So an OIC does toll the statute for collection. It tolls the statute from the time that the offer was submitted until the time that either the offer was rejected plus 30 days, because the taxpayer has 30 days to appeal a rejected OIC, or until the taxpayer voluntarily withdrew their OIC. I don't say until the time that the OIC was accepted, because if it's accepted, then it's not an issue, because the tax will be compromised and the statute won't come into play, because the taxpayer only has so much time to pay the OIC off, depending on whether or not it's a periodic payment OIC or a lump sum payment OIC. What you could do is order account transcripts and see if the OIC has been received. So I always send those in certified mail so that you have proof that the OIC was submitted. Usually it takes maybe 30 to 60 days to get a letter back from the IRS saying that they received the OIC. And then it says, though, that somebody will contact you within 90 days or something. And then 90 days later, you may get another letter saying that they need more time, and someone will contact you within another 90 days. It usually takes somewhere between 6 months and a year to get contacted by the OIC examiner on a submitted OIC. And the IRS has 2 years to process that OIC. And if after 2 years it hasn't been accepted or rejected, then it's considered to be accepted. But they put a tickler in their file. So usually you hear from them, if not within the first year, within the first year and a half. And then they're in a hurry to wrap it up because they only have 6 months to make a decision. But I've never seen an OIC go to the 2 years. Usually they contact you before the 2 year period.
All right, moving on to Jack. Another member is asking, would the IRS make you sell your home that has a lot of equity before putting you in non-collectible status? What about the other assets, cars, collectibles, et cetera?
So there's really two issues here. One is, what happens if you owe taxes and you have equity? So normally they're not looking to sell your house under you and make you homeless, but they do want to get paid. And so if your income and expenses are such that there's not sufficient disposable income to enter into installment agreement, then normally you could be put into not collectible status. But remember, the IRS minimum monthly installment payment is $25. So to be currently non-collectible would mean that you have less than $25 a month disposable income. And you don't want to show negative disposable income because that's a red flag. Because how long can a taxpayer work in the red? If they have savings and they're depleting their savings because their income isn't sufficient to pay their expenses, well, that's an asset. And so they're not going to put you in currently non-collectible if you have enough money in the bank to make up a shortfall. So what they usually do is, they want you to apply for a home equity loan. And then if you qualify for a home equity loan, to take out that loan and to pay that equity to the IRS. If you submit a request for a home equity loan and the lender denies it and you show the IRS the rejection letter, then you may qualify for non-collectible status. And we've been successful with that, where taxpayers did have equity, but they couldn't tap into that equity with a loan. And so they were put into either non-collectible or a low payment installment agreement based on that. So, and again, they don't want your cars. But they do want the equity. So again, I think there's some like lenders that lend money on auto equity, like pink slip loans or something, where they take a security interest in the auto and make a loan based on the equity in the automobile. So what I would do before requesting that non-collectible status, if I had equity in a home, is apply for a home equity loan. And actually, in this case, hope that the home equity loan is denied. And when you make that request for non-collectible status, that you also submit the rejection letter of the home equity loan, so the IRS can see that you tried to pull equity out of your home, but couldn't. And as a side, you don't really ask for non-collectible status. You ask for I'd rather ask for a very low payment installment agreement of $25 or $50 a month. And if they determine that you don't even have the resources to pay them $25 or $50 a month, then they'll put you in non-collectible. But the thing is, an installment agreement request can be appealed, but a non-collectible status request cannot. So you're better off requesting a low payment installment agreement and have and retain your appeal rights than to request non-collectible status and have no appeal rights.
Thank you, Norman. Would you suggest more than one lender denial letter?
No, I'd start with one.
Just one?
I think one's enough.
All right. Thank you. Hopefully that helps you out there. Jack, moving on to Carrie. Another member is asking, how long after the statute of limitations expires on collection can the IRS collect from a lien? Can you force the IRS to cancel a lien after the statute of limitations expires on collections, or at their discretion, can they keep the lien until the property is sold?
Okay, so the purpose of a federal tax lien is to secure the taxpayer's indebtedness to the IRS. If the collection statute expires, then there is no indebtedness because the debt is uncollectible. At that point, the IRS lien is released. So if it's a normal statute of limitations, which is 10 years from the date of assessment, that tax lien expires the same time that the statute on collection expires. If for some reason that collection statute was tolled, then the IRS can extend the tax lien until that statute does expire. So really, they can't collect after the statute expires and they release the lien. The only question is, does the statute expire after the 10 years, or was there some tolling event and the statute is expanded and the time expires? Is extended, and at that time, if the IRS renewed the lien timely, then the lien was also extended, but again, only till the statute date, not beyond.
All right, moving on to Norma, another member. My client was just awarded CNC status for several years, but has not filed for 2017. It looks like they're going to owe for 17 too. What impact will that have on CNC status, and will they leave them alone since they already approved the CNC?
So if a taxpayer is in currently non-collectible status and incurs additional tax liability, number one is that additional tax liability is not deemed non-collectible because it's not in the original non-collectible agreement. So they could go, even though the other years are non-collectible, they could still go and collect on 2017. And to go even further, they may deem that the additional tax liability breached the non-collectible status and allows them to go after all the years. So the real lesson of this is, if you're in currently non-collectible status, you don't want to incur additional tax liability, because that additional tax liability will not be in CNC status, and it may affect the CNC status for the other years. Now, it is possible to call them up and to get 2017 into the CNC status with the rest of the years, but you may have to submit new income and expense information, submit a new 433F to prove that you're still currently non-collectible, and put 17 into with the rest. But whatever is the cause of under withholding, you really need to address that issue so that you don't owe for future years and that you're not under reporting, under withholding every year.
All right, moving on here to Harvey. Harvey's asking, I understand that when an OIC is submitted, IRS stops collections and installment agreements in place. Does that mean also that if you submit a current tax return resulting in a refund, that they will release the refund?
No, it doesn't mean that. And so, and remember, it's an OIC. If an OIC is submitted, and this is important, in good faith, that it tolls collection. And so if the IRS determines that the installment agreement was, or the OIC was submitted solely to delay collection or in bad faith, then they will not stop collection. Also, part of the OIC agreement is that they can keep any refunds for the tax year when the OIC was accepted. So when the IRS accepts the OIC, if there's a tax refund due for that year, they'll keep the refund. Future refunds, they will release to the taxpayer, but the refund pending when the OIC is accepted belongs to the IRS, unfortunately.
All right, moving on here to Lena. Lena's asking, can you prove an amount for healthcare that exceeds the standard, or is the standard for healthcare the maximum that you cannot exceed when submitting an offer? Does it matter if OIC or installment agreement?
Okay, so there's a standard for out-of-pocket healthcare, and it varies whether you're under or over 65. So they look at the number of people in the household, and they determine how many are under 65 and how many are over, and determine the standard out-of-pocket healthcare expense standard is based on those numbers. However, if the healthcare exceeds the standard, then you're allowed the actual healthcare expenses as long as you can prove them. So you would need to have something, you know, statements from the doctor and cancel checks showing that you've been paying the doctor or medication or out-of-pocket medical or whatever. But as long as you can prove it, you're allowed, and there's really no limit because the IRS isn't going to tell a taxpayer that they should forego their life-saving medicine in order to pay the IRS. And so any healthcare expenses that are necessary and reasonable and can be proven are allowed, and there's really no limit as long as you can prove it.
All right. Now, before we get to the next round of questions here, I do want to start teeing up for those of you who are on the line to go ahead and submit some questions online if you wish for us to address anything that you might have on your mind. Martin, I received yours, so we're going to try to get to yours here very shortly. But I also want to take an opportunity to mention to you folks, last time we had this call, we mentioned a save the date. Well, now it's confirmed. Our next TRI 8th Annual Tax and Tax Resolution Forum full day event is coming up on November 14th, 2019. So November 14th is going to be our full day event. We're going to do what we do normally and broadcast it live over the internet for those of you who are out of state or don't want to fly in. And for those of you that are local or willing to fly in, you will have the opportunity to be in person in the room to meet with all of us and be participate during this live event, full 8 hours. And we are offering CPE for this. I am going to email you now a link giving you more details to the upcoming event. Again, the date is November 14th. It's a full-day event. A lot of new information that we're releasing here, It's going to be different from the other events that we've had, so please go ahead and register today. And as always, I do have a little extra bump for those of you who've attended today during this practitioners forum. I am going to give you an early bird special, take $100 off the November 14th date. You can pick whatever event, the live or over the internet, but it is not available for the rebroadcast, which happens a few days after. So it's $100 off for the November 14th date only. I am pushing a link now with the promo code. So those of you who are interested, go ahead and take advantage. It is an early bird special and available if you sign up today. All right, Norman, let's move on to the next round of questions here. This is next one is from Jamie. And Jamie is asking, taxpayer has unfiled returns for 10 plus years and has been self-employed for most of that time. He worked a couple of jobs where they issued W-2s and now received a letter from the IRS asking to file 2015 and 2016. Will the IRS be asking for all the delinquent returns? Client has already indicated records are almost non-existent for that period of time.
Right. So I would start by preparing the 2015 and 16 returns because that's all the IRS is asking for at this time. And they may or may not ask for the other delinquent returns. And the reason is if you order wage and income transcripts, you'll see exactly what the IRS has on the taxpayer in terms of W-2s or 1099s or 1098s. And you can determine whether or not the taxpayer has what's called filing enforcement, which means if the taxpayer's wage and income transcripts don't show any income or shows income that's below the threshold to prepare a return, then the IRS will determine that a return is not required for that year, and they won't ask for a return. And so if he doesn't have records anyways, and it's 10 plus years, I wouldn't worry so much about that, and I would concentrate on the years that the IRS is requesting delinquent returns, which in this case is 2015 and 16. And I would order wage and income transcripts. I think you can order wage and income transcripts up to 10 years. So what I would do just to be safe is I would order wage and income transcripts, from 2009 or 10 to 2018. And I would prepare those 15 and 16 returns only, but I'd also prepare 17 and 18. But I wouldn't go back beyond 15 unless the wage and income transcripts showed sufficient income through W-2s or 1099s to warrant returns.
All right, Jamie, hopefully that helps you and gives you a little bit of guidance there. Moving on to Robert. Robert is asking, business client owes $96,000 in trust fund recovery, and of that total amount, $38,000 is penalties for failure to file, failure to pay, and failure to deposit. I am now working with the revenue officer. I know there is no getting around the trust fund. However, is there a way to reduce the failure to file penalties to failure to file timely penalties? In the case, I think he means payment, failure to file, failure to pay. In the case of late filing of W-2 and W-3s, the penalty drops from 10% of total W-3 to $50 to $100 per W-2 return. Once they submit a late W-2 and W-3, can this also be applied for 941 and 940s? If so, what is the IRM code?
Okay, so I'm a little confused because when you say business client, does that mean your client is some corporation or LLC or other entity? Because trust fund recovery penalty is only assessed against responsible persons, and a trust fund recovery penalty is only assessed against a responsible person when we're talking about a corporation or an LLC, because a sole proprietorship wouldn't have trust fund recovery penalty. The sole proprietor would be responsible for all the payroll tax. Remember, trust fund recovery penalty is just the portion of the payroll tax that was withheld from the employee. And trust fund recovery penalty doesn't include these other kinds of penalties like late payment or late filing or whatever. So I'm really not sure if you represent an individual who's been assessed trust fund recovery penalty, or if you represent a corporation or LLC or other entity that owes payroll tax liability. And then the question about the failure to file and failure to pay penalties. Right. So if you, that's a civil penalty, and that can be mitigated by filing the W-2s and W-3s. But remember, that's filed with the Social Security Administration, not the IRS. And then can it be applied to 941s and 940s? No. Again, I'm not sure what you're asking, but 940 and 941 liability. Well, the 941 is the payroll tax liability in which the trust fund recovery penalty comes from. 940 is not assessed against responsible people. It's only assessed against the corporation. So I'm sorry I can't answer that better, because I'm not sure what you're asking, except that the penalties of failure to file and failure to pay penalties cannot be reduced, but the civil penalties can be reduced for failure to file the W-2s and 3s by going ahead and doing that, and then sending proof of that to what's called the CAWR unit, C-A-W-R, which stands for Combined Annual Wage Reporting Unit of the IRS.
All right, Robert, if you need further clarification, please give us a call, and we'll be able to help you with that. You might even consider signing up for the VIP membership so we can use some of your consultation time to really dive into this matter. All right, moving on to Shauna. Shauna is asking, can you speak on the differences between the California OIC versus an IRS OIC? Can I expect the taxpayer, if the taxpayer owes for both agencies, or what can I expect if the taxpayer owes for both agencies?
So IRS and California OIC programs are very, very different, where IRS has relies on national and local standards. California uses what they say is a case-by-case analysis. So it's not unusual where the taxpayer owes much more to the IRS than they do to California, and yet they're able to get a lower offer accepted to the IRS than to the Franchise Tax Board, because the Franchise Tax Board is using different criteria. So basically with the IRS, it's based on disposable income and comparison to what they would receive if they collected the disposable income for the life of the statute, where remember with California, the collection statute isn't 10 years, but it's 20 years. So if they're doing a comparison of collection to an offer, they're looking at 20 years instead of 10. So where the IRS, you might be able to submit an offer disposable income times 12 months, let's say. With the FTB, you'd want to be, it would be disposable income times, you know, 5 years or 6 years. So somewhere 60 or 70 months. And so an offer in California is much tougher and really only works if there's very little monthly disposable income. And if you multiply that by 60, that makes it worthwhile and that the taxpayer could borrow that money. Also, for remember, for either an OIC won't work if there's sufficient equity in the home or other assets to pay the tax. So OIC is really looking for someone who either doesn't own a home or has no equity in their home and has very little monthly disposable income. So it's not for everybody, and most offers are rejected. And so you really need to know what you're doing when you submit an offer, because you really need to know what they may accept and what they won't accept. So very, very few offers submitted by taxpayers themselves are accepted. And our acceptance rate is probably as high as anyone in the industry, but that's because we do an analysis and determine whether or not an offer is the best method of dealing with the taxpayer's tax issues, or if an installment agreement is better, or if we can get them in currently non-collectible, or if they're might be subject to a bankruptcy. So there are other issues besides submitting an offer, and you really need to look at all the options to determine which is best for that particular taxpayer.
All right, Shauna, hopefully that explains it a little bit better for you. Moving on to Michael. Michael's asking, client ignored notices from the IRS on an old company he had and since stopped operating. His personal account was levied to the tune of $25,000. Under what circumstances will the IRS return the levied money if the liability was for the company?
So if the liability was for the company, first of all, I'd have to know what kind of liability are we talking about. Is it payroll tax or 1120 or 940? And the other thing is, even if it's his personal bank account, was the old company a sole proprietorship? Was it a corporation? Did it have an EIN? And so these are all kinds of questions that I would need to know before I responded. But they got to the taxpayer's personal bank account through his social security number. So I'd have to know how that social security number is linked to the old company. Because remember, when you request an EIN, they ask for the requester's social security number. So that EIN is linked to the social security number. Also, when the IRS levies the bank, they instruct the bank to hold those funds somewhere between 14 and 21 days, which gives the taxpayer time to contact the IRS and see what the issue is and possibly have the IRS instruct the bank to release the funds back to the taxpayer. But you need to act quickly, because the time to act is the time that the funds are frozen and that the bank is still has retained the funds and hasn't sent them to the IRS yet. Once the bank releases the funds to the IRS, it's much, much harder to get back as a refund from the IRS. It's much, much, much easier to deal with it while the bank is still holding the funds and to get the IRS to either release or partial release the funds, even maybe setting up a installment agreement or something else. But the time to deal with the IRS is before the bank releases the funds to them and while the bank is still holding on to them. and hopefully you can get the IRS to release or partially release those funds.
All right, thank you, Norman. Moving on to Darby. Darby asked, taxpayer was audited, income adjusted up, expenses adjusted down. Taxpayer petitioned the tax court, but only for expenses. The power of attorney on file neglected to address the income. Entered into an agreed tax court order through power of attorney more than a year ago. Received notice to pay $250,000. Now realize on the income side that a $400,000 levy release was counted as income. The $400,000 levy was a debit on the bank statements and then showed as a credit the same month when the levy was released. It was a wash. Auditor added the $400K to the income. The power of attorney neglected to petition that issue. Tax court was final. No audit reconsideration after tax court. No Dallas to liability offering compromise after tax court. $250,000 of phantom liability. Taxpayer does not qualify for Dallas to collectability offer. What can be done?
So the simple answer is they probably have a professional negligence or sometimes called malpractice suit against the POA because that really should have been caught. And it's really below the standards of a professional to allow that to happen. So what can be done? The answer is probably to sue the power of attorney for malpractice.
But nothing on the IRS side, huh? They exhausted everything.
No, because the tax court decision was a stipulated decision that was signed off by both parties. And so that's written in stone. That can't be changed.
All right, Darby, wish we could give you better news there. Moving on to the next question here from Jared. A year ago or so, the IRS started a program of an expanded installment agreement permitting installment agreements amounts up to $100,000 over 84 months with no collection information statement. Is that program still going, and is it available if the account has been assigned to a field revenue officer for collection? Our local revenue officer who contacted the taxpayer to collect said that it was no longer available once the account is sent to him to collect. Is this correct?
Okay, so first of all, at least here in Southern California, a case isn't even assigned to a revenue officer unless the taxpayer owes more than $250,000. So if a case is assigned to a revenue officer, they're not even able to do that extended installment agreement. They don't qualify. They owe way too much. The other thing is, I went onto the IRS website to look up the expanded installment agreement, and it was taken down. So in that expanded installment agreement started out as a test, and it went for about a year, and then they decided to continue it, and then it kind of disappeared. So I'm not sure whether or not that expanded installment agreement is still an active program or not, because it's been taken down from their website. However, when I called the ACS, I was able to get a couple taxpayers into the expanded program. So either those ACS reps didn't know that it was taken down, or they took it down from the website. But if you know it, if you know about it, you can still ask for it, which is not unusual for the IRS in the sense that the IRS has certain programs that they don't advertise and they don't make known. And so you kind of have to know about them in order to ask about them. And if you don't know about them, the IRS won't volunteer the information. So the expanded installment agreement, I wouldn't be surprised, is something that they'll look into if you ask about it. But if you don't, they won't recommend or even tell you that it's a possibility. The other thing is, expanded installment agreement is like a streamline in that financials aren't required. But once a case is assigned to a revenue officer, that revenue officer's job is to investigate your financials and determine your ability to pay. So, so no, a revenue officer is not going to put you into a streamline or an expanded installment agreement because their job is to determine your ability to pay, not just to put you into one of these streamline programs. And that's why, for instance, when you're dealing with ACS, you can use a 433F. But once a case is assigned to a revenue officers always require a 433A. And where an F is sufficient for ACS, it's not for the IRS revenue officer. And the difference is between a two-page form and a six-page form. So once it's assigned to a revenue officer, there's really no more shortcuts. You have to go the long way.
All right. Moving on to Edward. Edward's asking a question. I have a client working on an OIC for him. They have been separated since 2012 and living separately but never divorced. A couple of years ago, I submitted an OIC for him, my client, and provided a notarized separation agreement and all the necessary documents. In short, it was later rejected because the IRS insisted on a copy of the divorce decree. At the end, it was rejected. His tax return was married filing separately. Later, we filed his tax return as single. I don't know why or if they still ask for the divorce decree. I got a call from the IRS officer yesterday. How can we go around that divorce? Their religion allows separation and living away, but no divorce. Am I fighting a losing battle here?
Okay, so first of all, it would help me if I knew what state the taxpayers lived in, because I don't know if they live in a community property state like California or not. But I can tell you if they do live in a community property state, that if they're not divorced, and they're not even, I'm not even sure if they're legally separated, because legal separation is not accomplished by a notarized separation agreement. Legal separation is something that you submit to a court. And so I don't know if their religion allows them to submit separation agreements with the court or not. I guess what they could do is a postnuptial agreement, that if they do live in a community property state, a postnuptial agreement says that each one's earnings are separate and not community property. But it seems like if he filed married filing separately, and if you live in a community property state, that doesn't mean that they can't go after the non-filing spouse for the tax, because they can, because it's community property. In California, what's called a 100% community property state, which means they can go after 100% of the non-filing spouse's assets, as opposed to some states are 50%, where it'd only be 50%. And so if he's submitting an OIC and lives in a community property state, then they'll want the spouse's income to be included in the offer. But I guess you could also include the non-filing spouse's expenses, so it may be a wash, or it may not. But the big question is, and I really can't answer without knowing, is what state they live in and whether or not it's a community property state. But if they do live in a community property state, then I think you pretty much have to include the wife's information in the offer.
All right, Edward, if you have any questions there, give us a call. Moving on to the questions here online. Norman, this is from Martin. Martin's asking, a Chapter 13 client owes $58,000 from 2016, which was not part of their Chapter 13 filing. I have been sending various documents and Form 433F to the address on the notices, but without any response except for them to send more demand for payment. What are my next steps to resolve this issue? So it looks like he's been doing it by mail only.
So I don't get it. The taxpayer's in a Chapter 13?
Correct.
And the tax is a post-petition?
Correct.
Okay. So normally what happens in a case like that is the IRS files what's called an administrative claim. I think it's under Bankruptcy Code Section 1301, which says that post-petition taxes are administrative claims and are priority and get paid before other claims. So I think what's going to happen is the IRS is going to file an administrative claim in the taxpayer's Chapter 13, and unless he provides for payment of that tax liability in the bankruptcy, that that the IRS is going to file a motion to dismiss the bankruptcy. And even if they don't file a claim in the bankruptcy, theoretically, the Chapter 13, all the taxpayer's disposable income is going to the Chapter 13 trustee in terms of monthly plan payments in the Chapter 13 plan. So I don't know where the taxpayer would come up with money to be paying the IRS this post-petition tax liability outside the plan when the taxpayer supposedly has pledged all his disposable income to the plan. So the lesson is, if you're in a Chapter 13 or any bankruptcy for that matter, but especially if you're in a Chapter 13, you don't want to incur post-petition tax liability. And I'm not sure how they did, because, you know, withholding would have been part of the taxpayer's budget and would have been provided for in their expense in their Schedule J. So I don't know how it happened, but my guess is the IRS is either going to file an administrative claim, in which case it's going to have to be paid in the plan, or is going to file a motion to dismiss the Chapter 13, or somehow the taxpayer is going to have to come up with money to pay outside the plan. And that's basically the options.
All right. Moving on here to another question. This is from Jushun. I have a client who is a real estate investor. His only income is from selling his houses. He would like to get a couple lump sum payments to pay off his debt, subject to the availability of his house sale. He does not want monthly installments. He wants to pay with big amounts whenever he sells his real estate investment. I told him that there is no such program in the IRS. Am I right?
I don't know of any program with the IRS that allows you to pay sporadically. You know, so the thing is, if he sells one house a year or whatever, then you have to take that and divide it by 12, and that's his like average monthly income, and then subtract the expenses and come up with a monthly payment plan. And what he needs to do is save money when he does sell a property and pay off. But no, there are no sporadic payment plans where you pay when you sell a house or come into income or whatever. All IRS payment plans are based on monthly numbers.
All right. This is we come across this a lot, Norman. This is from Jessica. I have an offer in compromise for a taxpayer that lives with his girlfriend, and the girlfriend has her own income but pays for only a few of the household items. Can just the amount of her income applied to those shared expenses be included? It looks like the IRS will apply her full income, which likely puts my client out of an offer.
So FTB, which is California Franchise Tax Board, treats it a little different than IRS, but IRS, you wouldn't necessarily have to include his girlfriend's income, and I wouldn't include the girlfriend's income in the taxpayer's income. But if possible, the taxpayer should pay his own living expenses and claim his actual expenses. So the thing is, no, for IRS purposes, the girlfriend's income would not be subject to the offer and not be included in the taxpayer's income.
All right, Jessica, hopefully that answers your question there. Now, everyone, this does bring us to the conclusion of this month's Tax Resolution Institute Practitioners Forum. I want to remind everyone of the special offer made today for the live seminar coming up on November 14th. I went ahead and pushed a link, so make sure you check your chat box, look for that link, including the promo code to get a $100 discount off of the sale price. Again, live seminar and live webcast coming up on November 14th, full 8 hours of CPE. You also get deals on the textbook, sales book. You get all those included as well. Again, thank everyone for joining us this month. We will be meeting next month on July 2nd. So mark your calendars. July 2nd is the next Practitioners Forum. We hope you enjoy the rest of your week and talk again next month. All the best.
Bye, everyone.